industrial and technological applications.
This week, we will talk about the vast world of alumina production, its various uses and markets. Plus, we will uncover how this seemingly simple item has made broad contributions to knowledge-based product development and the economy as a whole. So let's get started.
To become more familiar with alumina and its related products, we visited Altus Alumina. It is a company that specializes in making fused alumina oxide. Now you might be wondering where fused alumina is used. Alumina has a very high melting point and is a crystal-type powder used in grinding, blasting, and cutting processes. Plus, it is an ingredient in various formulations to make things like fire-retardant glass and ceramic glaze. Fused alumina is also used to make various types of catalyst as well. Alumina doesn't quite naturally exist in nature. It is actually synthetically produced, which is no easy task. However, bauxite, which is the raw material alumina comes from, can be found in abundance in the country's mineral reserves. Bauxite ore is extracted from mines. Then it undergoes a refining process that includes digesting it in piping hot sodium hydroxide, where it's also electrocuted. Then it is filtered and fed to a rotary furnace, where it dries at super high temperatures until it becomes a fine crystalline substance. The production facilities of this company are located in Khorasan-e-Razavi province. It is conveniently close to one of the largest bauxite mines in the country, where it gets the majority of its raw material.
It might be interesting to know that a lot of the equipment and technology used to make alumina in the country have all been domestically produced. That is significant because this machinery was previously imported through difficult custom processes, which were often time-consuming and, more importantly, very expensive. So indigenizing technology used in knowledge-based industries to produce value-added products is key to expanding the size of related markets.
The beating heart of this company is its massive and high-tech research and development department. This knowledge-based company has obtained the technical know-how of producing various grades of alumina. This department carries out studies on the structural, physical, and chemical properties of alumina oxide and improve its performance for different uses. Customers can also make special requests depending on the product they want to make. The research and development department then creates the optimal formula of fused alumina to suit the customer's needs. On another note, while fused alumina is produced in small quantities by other companies, the quality of these productions is often fairly low. This has led industry participants to look to imports to meet their needs. However, this company has saved the country millions in imports while matching international standards for product quality. Presently, this knowledge-based firm is standing on the cusp of exporting its products. It hopes to gain a high share of foreign markets to meet regional demands. This is easily possible as fused alumina is not abundantly produced in the West Asian region and is typically imported into the area. As part of its future vision, this company wants to expand this particular industry to produce high-quality products. It also wants to introduce new items that can be used in down-the-line industries.
From laminates and paints to concrete, cement, and tiles, alumina is an important ingredient in numerous products. Iran is a leading producer of many of these items that it also exports to neighboring regions. But alumina is mainly used to make the metal we are all familiar with, which is aluminum. And Iran's market is thriving with aluminum ingot production skyrocketing in recent years.
Official figures show Iran is among the top 15 producers of aluminum in the world. Last year, Iran produced over 400,000 tons of aluminum ingots, which is roughly 55,000 tons more than the year before. That is based on figures from the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization, also known by the acronym IMIDRO. Going after figures from IMIDRO, the total production of aluminum has roughly doubled over the past 2 years. This comes as aluminum bauxite production surged by well over 13% in the same period. Last year, around 1 million tons of bauxite were produced. Meanwhile, the government is planning on increasing annual aluminum production to 1.5 million tons by the year 2026. This means that alumina production must also increase accordingly. So, how many bauxite reserves are there in the country? Iran has one major bauxite mine, which is located in North Khorasan province. Jojaram mine has an estimated total of 30 million tons of reserves, but only 7 million tons of it are proven reserves. This mine is owned by Iran's sole alumina producing company, which is also owned by IMIDRO. So far, this company has explored and owned nearly 20 bauxite zones in various areas nationwide. But these zones are primarily used as extra feed for the Jojaram alumina refinery.
Iran is well known for its copious mineral reserves. In fact, the country has over 60 billion tons of mineral reserves, of which some 40 billion tons are proven reserves. That is based on figures from the National Geological Survey and Mineral Exploration Agency. The Ministry of Mining says the productions in this sector are worth some $22 billion. But so far, productions haven't met this potential value.
Industry participants say the country is not using all of its mining potentials. There are several reasons for this. One is the need to further develop the technology and research necessary to expand this sector. Areas that need more attention are geological exploration to discover new reserves and calculating mineable reserves. Plus, there are lucrative investment opportunities for engineering extraction and refining equipment. But that's not all. Once the results are in, related bodies with the know-how to conduct necessary material research are also needed to develop products. And here is where knowledge-based companies, such as the one we just mentioned, play a big role in the mining sector. Presently, there are well over 7,000 knowledge-based companies in Iran. One of this amount, nearly 900 of them, are active in the field of advanced materials and products that are based on chemical technologies. In its transition to a knowledge-based economy, the government has stepped up its support for knowledge-based firms and research institutions. Through the Science and Technology Office and the National Innovation Fund, the government has provided provisions that encourage activities in the mining field. Despite Iran being the third most sanctioned country by the United States, it has made major gains in its industrial developments and added value productions. Such efforts have led to self-sufficiency in many sectors.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there on the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
Today, we are visiting a company that matches buyers of agricultural products to farmers and removes the middlemen. Therefore, products will be delivered directly to customers from farm to table. And that's not the only thing they're doing here. Let's find out more.
Okay, now I'm just looking at the website that this company has. They've done something very important, and that is gathering, farmers from all around Iran, and then finding what sort of product each farmer is growing in his farm, and then matching these farmers to buyers. For example, just look here, they've got different sorts of, for example, sesame from different producers in different cities. And why is this important? See, they've got a variety of products. Iran is a four-season country. It means that all around the year, there are certain products that are grown in different parts of the country. So when we do not have, for example, watermelons in one part of the country, the other part is producing them. So whenever a buyer wants to purchase watermelons, for instance, he can just simply find it here. And this is amazing. In addition to their website, this company also has an application, which is named Café Mifé. You can order fruit and vegetables that are fresh and handpicked for your parties or ceremonies. And you see, here in this company, they have a special section that they pack these fruit, they sort them out first, and based on their quality, they pack them like this. And then they will send them directly to your houses. So let's go to that section and find out how they do it. In this line, they pack the products. Okay, fruit and vegetables that are fresh come here, and then they handpick them and categorize them into three groups: grade 1, grade 2, and grade 3. Grade 1 is the one that has the highest quality and apparently looks better. It also has the highest price. Then customers go to the application and choose which one of these products they want. And then they just sort them and pack them like these and quickly send them to your house. From farm to table is a phrase you might all have heard. This means that buyers can directly purchase their products, which is fresh fruit and vegetables, directly from farmers. And this is exactly what this company is doing by cutting out brokers. Thank you.
There is so much more to say about this industry and its related trades. So without further ado, let's dive right into some news and trends in this field. As mentioned throughout the program, catalysts are important in boosting production in a whole host of industries. Now, Iranian experts have succeeded in domestically producing two types of catalysts used in the petrochemical sector. It's a major achievement as the petrochemical industry makes 35 million tons of final products for downstream sectors and exports annually. The National Petrochemical Company says out of 85 types of catalyst used in this industry, 22 of them are domestically made. Much of Iran's development and expansion of the oil sector is largely owed to its knowledgeable engineers. Such services are also being exported beyond the country's borders. Earlier this year, Iran entered an agreement with Romania to export technical services to the country's gas sector. Based on the agreement, Iran would provide engineering services to construct gas transmission lines, storage tanks, and other necessary facilities in Romania. Plus, the arrangement seeks to explore joint investment opportunities in various fields, such as the feasibility of building refineries and power plants. One of the trends we are seeing in the oil and gas sector is the government's determination to expand its developments. One path to achieving this goal is to increase collaboration with knowledge and research-based companies and academic institutions. The plan for using domestic capacities for innovation in the oil industry has been put at the top of the agenda for years. One example is the massive Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, signed between the Iranian Oil Innovation and Technology Park with knowledge-based companies. This agreement covers a variety of areas, such as providing capital, developing artificial intelligence, and so much more. With that, we are fresh out of time. Thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام متى أشفي غيظي إذا غضبت أحين أعجز عن الانتقام فيقال لي لو صبرت أم حين أقدر عليه فيقال لي لو عفوت.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam used to say, "If I am angry, when shall I vent my anger? When I am unable to take revenge, and it be said to me, better you endure, or when I have power to take revenge, and it be said to me, better forgive."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. We find, dear friends, in the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, that Imam Ali was an individual who looked towards Allah. He had tawakkul, trust and reliance upon Allah. And he had his hopes on Allah. We do not find in any place that Imam Ali alayhi salam put forth his hand out in need from another human being. Whenever he raised his hands or whenever he put forth his hand out of need, it was towards the Almighty, Allah.
And so here we find a very interesting aspect of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And in his own words, His Eminence, the first disciple, the first Imam, the first successor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, he says, whoever sets their hope on others, that person on whom they set their hope upon creates an awe and glory in your heart. So in case it was a little bit confusing, so Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying that this person who you set your hopes upon, that person, their awe and their glory and their respect and their honor is created in your heart. So here we have two aspects. One aspect is this, that if we hope and rely upon another human being, then we will have awe and glory and honor in our hearts regarding that individual. When in reality, an individual is not upon whom we should pin our hopes upon. For it is Allah who ultimately gives, and it is Allah who ultimately takes. And so this in context, and this in mind, we realize that it is Allah upon whom our hopes should be. And when our hope and our trust and our reliance and our tawakkul is upon Allah, then it is the awe and the glory and the honor and the majesty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that is created in our heart, and not the awe and glory of another human being. And so, in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam, do not put your hope upon people. Rather, put your hope upon the owner and the creator of all of existence. Put your hope in the Almighty Allah. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma inni as'aluka al-aman يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يدي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger."
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When you and I and many individuals stand and say Ya Ali, it is in reference and in respect to the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. It's an utterance that indeed you and I have practiced and have mentioned throughout our lives. You find in many occasions people enjoy mentioning and remembering the commander of the faithful. There are people today who have emerged and have come forward and complained. Some of them have stood against this particular practice. They have said, why is it that you say Ya Ali? Surely you should say Ya Allah. Surely you should not call the names of certain individuals. First thing I would like to say is, when it comes to calling someone, is this permissible or not? All of us agree that indeed it's something that you and I practice on a regular basis. We call each other, isn't it, by their names. In fact, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does what? He calls his prophets. He says, Ya Musa. He calls Ibrahim. He calls Yahya. Yes, the prophets, he calls them. Not only does he call them, he says, we must remember them. We must utter their name. وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ مَرْيَمْ وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ إِبْرَاهِيمْ وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ هُمْ إِدْرِيسْ. Allah says, remember them, mention them. Therefore, the remembrance and the mentioning of these holy individuals is something sanctioned by the Holy Quran. Allah says, you should remember them. Who are you and I to come forward and say we should not recall the name of these holy individuals, isn't it? The first thing is this. The second, tell me, aren't we, you and I, and Muslims claiming to be the followers of the Holy Prophet? And when we say the followers of the Holy Prophet, that means whatever he does, we do. And whatever he says we should not do, we will not do. Tell me, who was one of the first few who came and said, Ya Ali? It was Rasulullah. You say, where? Let me give you examples. The hadith that is mutawatir, meaning authentic, established by in all Muslim books of hadith. The Prophet of Islam comes forward and says what? He says, Ya Ali, anta minni bimanzilati Haruna min Musa. Oh Ali, you are to me like what Aaron was to Moses. The Prophet of Islam says, Ya Ali, silmuka silmi, harbuka harbi. Oh Ali, the one who is at peace with you is at peace with me. And the one who fights you and the one is the one who fights me. The Prophet of Islam would say, Ya Ali, calling Amir al-Mu'mineen, and would say what? Ana wa anta min shajaratin wahida, wa baqin nas min shajaratin ukhra. You and I are from one tree, and the rest of the people are from different trees. Yes?
كل صبح وكل شراب أيام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاب قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
A recent report has placed Iran's economy in the 20th position in the world based on the gross domestic product, GDP, per capita, adjusted by purchasing power parity, PPP, in 2021. According to the International Monetary Fund, IMF, the value of Iran's GDP per capita when adjusted by PPP was $1.436 trillion in 2021. This means that despite the devilish designs of the U.S., Iran's economy is larger than and ahead of 173 countries, including those of West Europe and South America. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, Iran's Flourishing Economy, a Slap on the U.S. Face. Stay tuned for more. The workers are the backbone of a country's economy, which no power can undermine if brain and brawn combine together to meet the growing challenges. As a matter of fact, it is the faith in God and dedication to serve the nation that has enabled Iran's vast and varied manpower, with its skills ranging from hard labor in differing weather conditions to scientists and administrators using their innovative minds to make the country's economy and stability flourish in the face of over four decades of unjust sanctions, or more properly, the terrorism of the West against the Islamic Republic in almost all fields. No No wonder a recent report has placed Iran's economy in the 20th position in the world based on the gross domestic product, GDP per capita, adjusted by purchasing power parity, PPP, in 2021. According to the International Monetary Fund, IMF, the value of Iran's GDP per capita, when adjusted by PPP, was $1.436 trillion in 2021. This means that despite the devilish designs of the U.S., Iran's economy is larger than and ahead of 173 countries, including those of West Europe and South America. The IMF reports said last year the Netherlands, Switzerland, Sweden, Belgium, Austria, Norway, Portugal, Greece, and Finland, as well as Argentina, South Africa, Kuwait, Pakistan, Egypt, and Thailand, had smaller economies than the Islamic Republic of Iran. According to prediction for 2022, Iran's GDP, based on purchasing power index, will increase by $137 billion to $1.573 trillion. Indeed, this is a firm slap on the face of the U.S. and underscores the point that Iran's economic progress is no longer tied to the West's pressures to impose on it any flawed accord such as the JCPOA. As pointed by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in his address to a group of workers from all over the country, thanks to the efforts of Iranians in all fields, the country's economy does not depend on results of negotiations currently underway in Vienna to remove the illegal U.S. sanctions. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei noted, "The country's stronghold of production and economy is alive. Thank God it is standing. The army that stood against the enemy officers of the Holy Defense was made up of entrepreneurs and capable economic managers. Its warriors were also workers. The workers were the sincere and earnest warriors of this battle. You and all economic actors share in this honor of preserving the country's economy." These undeniable facts are ample proof that the United States cannot do a damn thing against the Islamic Republic of Iran, try what it may, against the faith and dedication of the Iranian people to steer the country towards the pinnacles of progress in all fields.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyah.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. We've been in the studio for today's discussion to discuss the life and works of another Shia dignitary, our two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniyah. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the life account of one of the most outstanding Shiite dignitaries of the 13th and 14th Hijra century. He is no one but Sayyid Abu al-Hasan al-Isfahani, the outstanding faqih, we can say, and religious authority, who, after the demise of the late Ayatollah Naini and Hayri Yazdi, he became the general religious authority of the Shiite world, Sayyid Abu al-Hasan al-Isfahani. Okay, let's start with the early life. What information do we have, Sheikh Ziyaniya, about his early life?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Abu al-Hasan al-Isfahani was born in a village close to the city of Isfahan in the year of 1284, according to lunar calendar. And as his name is clarifying, he was related to the city of Isfahan. His origin roots in the generation of the seventh Imam of Shia, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salatu wasalam. And even his grandfather was one of the most notable and outstanding scholars at his time, and was the student of Muhammad Hassan Najafi, mostly known as Sahib Jawahir. Ayatollah Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani started his Islamic studies in the Islamic Seminary of Isfahan. And although his family were not agree with Islamic studies, but he continued this field. And when he finished his primary studies in Isfahan, he moved to Najaf and continued his studies, Islamic studies, in the Islamic Seminary of Najaf.
That's right.
And here he got familiar with Akhund Khurasani, rahmatullah alay. And Akhund told his father that you may have the rest of your sons, but please let this one be mine. Mm-hmm. And Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani from that moment on continued to be a student of Akhund Khurasani for 17 years.
That's right.
And this is the moment that he is introduced to the Islamic world as a scholar, a great scholar.
Yes.
And after some years, he became the Imam of Jama'a prayer in the shrine of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam.
And then the Marja al-Am, isn't it?
After some years.
We can say he becomes the general religious authority of the whole Shia world in the city of Najaf. This position, Sheikh Mahdavi, was really significant, especially for Sayyid Abu al-Hasan al-Isfahani, because after Akhund al-Khurasani, it is passed to, we can say, people like Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tawatabai, Mirza, we can say, Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, you know. And it is after the late Shirazi that Sayyid Abu al-Hasan al-Isfahani is selected, isn't it, as the religious authority.
Yeah, as far as I read in his biography, your
turn. Okay, so talk a little bit about this general position for us. I mean, when you become the Marja al-Alam, this position is really important for the Muslims.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a very noble position, as you mentioned. When we consider the time of Ayatollah Sayyid Abu al-Hasan al-Isfahani, we see that among his teachers and also among his students, we can consider a lot of students who have reached the level of scholar or mujtahid.
Yes.
They are close to become a marja. So what is the actually difference between a mujtahid and marja? Mm-hmm. It's only one step to be taken by mujtahid to become a marja. So from the marja to become a marja'e amme, meaning that sitting at the position which none of the other mujtahids are going to claim for that position. Mm-hmm. So it makes that, okay, we have only one marja in this position. So all people, I mean Shia believers, will follow that single mujtahid. So it will create an umbrella, vast umbrella, which will include all of the people, including laymen, mujtahid, and so you don't you are not going to face controversy and a split among the people. Definitely. Regarding their issues.
Okay.
So that was a very high-ranked position, but we have to consider the lifestyle of Ayatollah Sayyid Abu al-Hasan al-Isfahani. I'm sure that when we go to Abu Badr, Sheikh Ziya, he also will narrate for us some of the memories, very beautiful, noble memories of his lifestyle that will put him to be taken as a role model.
That's right.
Not only for the talaba, I mean students of the
yes.
seminary schools,
yes.
even for the ordinary people.
Okay.
For example, in one of the, I just want to say one of the memories, which is something to do with his social life.
Okay,
this
good.
Has not become of being a marja.
Mm-hmm.
So it is narrated that in one of the Salat al-Jama'ah congregation prayer in the shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen, a person attacks his son, mm-hmm. I mean the son of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani, and
yes.
kills him.
Yes.
So at that position, you are sitting at the position of Marjaya Amma, even you don't need to go to the police and take this guy and then take him to the court and
mm-hmm.
start judging against him. You are at the position of Marjaya Amma. You can actually revenge as it is lawful. I mean, we have
right.
the retaliation
yes.
concept, which is qasas. But what does this Marja do? He
okay.
forgives.
Yes.
It is not understandable for us. We may talk easily that somebody is going to forgive
mm-hmm.
the murderer of his son. But when we consider all of these details, that somebody is not a very simple man. He is the marja amme.
Yes.
And that other person has killed his son and he forgives.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows that he was not
the
at the position.
Status and position.
Yes,
of
even
marja.
It was his right. To benefit from his right that was given or granted to him by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, by Sharia, to go for retaliation and qasas, but he forgives.
Mm-hmm.
This is one aspect of his life. And then another aspect to show his actually insight
mm-hmm.
and also to show his discern thought against the those who are against the Muhabbin al-Ahle Bayt, those
right.
who are against the Shia.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody asked him, okay, it is asked from Ayah Shubayriya Zanjani.
Yes.
The living marja right
okay,
now,
okay.
We are benefiting from his presence in Qom. He's leading the Salat
yes.
in Holy Shrine of Bibi Ma'suma in Qom. Somebody asked Ayatollah Shubayriya Zanjani, why a marja amma should not go for the Hajj?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is common that Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani, he didn't go for the Hajj.
He didn't go for Hajj.
So that is obligatory upon all mustati people.
Yes.
I mean, those who have this ability to afford it financially and physically, they have to go for Hajj. So Ayatollah Shubayri Zanjani, he is saying that Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani didn't go there. Why? Because he was of this view that if I go there, while I cannot revive the right of those four imams, I mean, I cannot reconstruct and give respect, full respect. I am there next to the tombs of those four
yes.
imams, and their tombs, I mean, their shrines are collapsed.
Yes.
This presence will authorize what Saudis have done.
In Jannatul Baqi.
Yes.
Of this month that this program is on air, is the commemoration day
yes,
for
8th of Shawwal.
8th of Shawwal, the demolition of Jannatul Baqi by the Saudis and the Wahhabis. So because he was not capable of reconstructing and, spending enough respect for the infallible imams.
Yeah, he said, okay, they may take advantage. Say, okay, because it was close. Historically,
okay. yes,
it was
yes.
close to the collapse of those things.
Yes,
so, okay.
Yes.
So if I go there,
uh-huh.
by my presence, even these leaders, I mean, the Wahhabi leaders,
okay.
we say, okay, we did that thing.
Yes.
We collapsed the shrines.
Yes. Yes.
And we see the marja amma of you, Shia,
come here,
have come.
Without saying anything.
Yes.
Okay.
So my presence
it's
might...
It's better not to go there now.
Yes.
Okay.
So
right.
he stayed away from the practicing
that's
obligatory
right.
worshipping act
okay.
in favor of what? Of giving this insight to the followers that was actually usury
mm-hmm.
and ghasb
yes.
of the rights of Ahlul Bayt.
That's all right. Thank you very much for this information. It was very kind of you. Politically and socially speaking, it was after, we can say, the independence of the people of Iraq and the Muslims and the Shiites who are living over there. Sayyid Abul Hasan al-Aswani as a marja was anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism on that time. Politically speaking, Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's talk a little bit about this aspect of the life of Sayyid.
Okay, yes. Beside his scholarly life, he had really a fruitful politic life.
And let me give you some examples. For example, when the nation of Iraq wanted to stand against the oppression of colonialism of England, Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani was the marja' that gave a verdict, a fatwa for people that this movement is wajib upon the shoulder of Muslimin to stand against the oppressors. Another important point is that after the World War I,
yes,
the First World War, because there were too many, you know, destructions all over the world, especially in Europe and in Muslim countries even, the ambassador of Britain came to visit the late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. And late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani accepted his request, I mean the ambassador's request, to have a visit with Ayatollah. And when the ambassador came, it is quoted that the prime minister of Iraq at that time, that was Nuri Sa'id, he was also accompanying the ambassador. And when all the people were sitting in the gathering, in the meeting, and it was a, you know, official meeting, the ambassador of England said to the Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani that, yes, this war was really deconstructive for your country and for Muslim nation. And the government of England took an oath that if they could have victory in this war, they would give a donation and a gift to you to spend this money for the benefit of Muslim Ummah.
Yes.
And then he gave a check of 100,000 dinars to the late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. And all the people are visiting this and observing this event. Okay. Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani accepted the check and put it under
the mattress.
The mattress that he was sitting on.
Yes.
And he started to speak. And he said, yes, this war was really fatal and was really deconstructive for the world. And I knew that Europe also is really suffering from the disadvantages of this war. And I'm sure that your country also faces with many problems. And if you let me, I want to give you also a gift. And then Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani brings out the check that the ambassador has given to him. And then he put another check on it with the amount of 100,000 dinars and says, you know that we are also in shortage of resources, but accept this gift from the Muslim Ummah and spend it in your country to help your people, because I know that there are too many poor people nowadays in England.
That's all right.
And okay. Nuri Said says, when we get out of the house of late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, I hear the ambassador saying that we wanted to buy the marja
to
of
bribe, in fact.
Yeah.
Yes.
We wanted to bribe the marja' of Shia population in the world, but he flipped the table and he disgraced us in front of all the people in the official meeting.
That's right. That's all right. This is really the true. When you become the marja' of the whole Muslims or the Shia world, then you have to be considered with even these trivial points. I mean, as a marja', you have to have it in your mind. And on that time, we know that Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani was such a person. What information do you have about his scholar life? I mean, his compilations and books, Shaykh?
Yeah. Sometimes for our listeners to really figure out the position of the marja, because of the historical distance among them and the lifestyle of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, it might be a bit difficult for them, but for now, if we speak of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, they will definitely understand who we are talking about, his position in knowledge and scholarly life.
Yes.
So now I'm going to take one example in order to make the position of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani known to our listeners. We know the book Tahrir al-Wasila.
Yes, by the late Imam Khomeini.
Yes, by the late. So what is this book? Exactly.
Okay.
This book exactly is a commentary of Imam Khomeini on what? On the book of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. So it shows the level of knowledge of Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, because when you take one book and then you put your comments on that book, okay, meaning that For now, for that time, I mean, the time Imam Khomeini was actually developing his knowledge and his scholarly life. So he take the book of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani because he...
Vasilatun Najat.
Yes, Vasilatun Najat, because he sees that book in a position that could be taken and could be commented on introduced to the followers as the fatwa'i book.
That is Qizi a faqih fatwa'i book. Okay.
Yes.
And Imam Khomeini, by writing a commentary,
yeah,
the Council compiled Tahrir al-Vasila.
Okay. Yes, and right. Also regarding the usul.
Yes.
His discussions and taqrirat, I mean, the compilation of his lessons by his students is really noble, of high rank among the students of Hausa nowadays. And he is mainly known of having very strong lessons on usul because he was a direct student of Marhum Akhund
Khorasani,
that's the author of Kifayatul Usul. It is one of the famous Usuli books, which is taught in a high advanced of the Hausa.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziania. We can say the Hajjah 9th, 1365, according to the Hijjah calendar, is a day that this outstanding Marja passed away. His body was taken from Al-Kazamiyya to Najaf al-Ashraf, and he was buried in one of the courtrooms around the holy shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam. May Allah bless the soul of the Marja Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani, the compiler of Vasilatun Najah. Thank you much, Sheikhs, for your presence in the program, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all, fi amanallah. Allah.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, COVID-19 has become the third leading cause of death in the United States after heart disease and cancer. Amid all of this pain, President Joe Biden has dropped most pandemic restrictions, stopped most national tracking, and failed to act on even the most basic federal actions to rein this pandemic in. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Analia Mejia Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As U.S. Marks 1 Million COVID Deaths, Biden Has Dropped Most Pandemic Protections. Here's more. One million deaths, an unthinkable milestone when this pandemic started. And even this gruesome number doesn't capture who and what the U.S. has lost. 1 million lives lost, dreams unfulfilled, families heartbroken, and futures cut short. This loss is unimaginable, and the Americans have only just begun to scratch the surface of how their communities will continue to grapple with this mass death and violence, surely for generations to come. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, COVID-19 has become the third leading cause of death in the United States after heart disease and cancer. Amid all of this pain, President Joe Biden has dropped most pandemic restrictions, stopped most national tracking, and failed to act on even the most basic federal actions to rein this pandemic in. Disabled and chronically ill Americans have been left adrift. In a maskless world, many of people in the U.S. are unable to safely leave their homes. They need swift, immediate action at a global level. Fighting this pandemic as if they can defeat it alone has failed. It's time.